Hi, I'm Jim Grierson.
And hi, I am Will Leach, and this is the Grierson and Leach Podcast, episode 28 of our podcast here at the New Republic. Grierson, how are you feeling today? Are you feeling good? It is August. It is officially August. We have made it. I hate August. August is like the most pointless month.
Yeah, especially if you are not going away on vacation, which I am not. It's just a cruel, slow reminder that other people are away with their loved ones and you are not.
Yes, and you are, in fact, stuck with your loved ones. That is the problem with August. All right, so this is the episode 28. Of course, we remind everyone, please follow us on Twitter at Grierson Leach. Email us at griersonleach@newrepublic.com. I remind you, by the way, I am producing the podcast now, so this is a work in progress. I think you saw some improvements last week. I'm having a little bit more fun with it. But as always, there are certain things I'm not going to get exactly right. I think last week there's some issues with levels that happen occasionally, mostly because I yell. It is a problem of growing up in a family of people that talk very loud. So in Grierson, much more soothing family. Your family is a much more soothing family than mine, Grierson.
It's true. They are very soothing.
They make me fall asleep every time I even look at them. So anyway, we'll try to ease out the levels. But if you have any thoughts, it'd be nice about it, because I said this is my third ever producing podcast. But if you have any suggestions or think, hey, Will, I produce podcasts or I do podcasts and I hear this thing that's happening, here's how to fix it. Please feel free to email either griersonleach@newrepublic.com or me, williamfleach@yahoo.com. All right, but first off, we remind you as always to subscribe to us on iTunes and find us on SoundCloud. And of course, please give us a review on iTunes. If you give us a review and the name of a movie, we will feature you in our reboot section, in which we discuss a movie from the past for, I wouldn't say in depth, but for a while. And so this week we have two reboot movies. The first reboot movie comes to us from WhoDog12 from June 26, 2016. Enjoyable podcast, 5 stars. Thanks for the podcast. Review Shawshank and Quiz Show, 2 favorites. Well, we've already talked about Shawshank, so today we will be discussing Quiz Show. The second review comes to us from Shabelles. That's like the Shabelles S, but this is with a Z, so you know it's like
Yes.
And Shabelle Z from March 30th, 2016 says, great compliment to your podcast lineup if you're a movie buff. 5 stars. I've become a big fan of this podcast. They speak in a tone that may seem unusual against standard movie reviews, but the candor and humor is refreshing. I can even get over the fact that Leach sounds like Jimmy Olsen on Percocet. Oh, I love a good Bissinger joke. Thanks, guys, and keep up the great work. If you have it in your heart, I'd love to hear a Fletch review. So we will be discussing Chevy Chase's Fletch. But we only have one big movie released to review this week, and that movie is Jason Bourne.
I know who I am.
When we have finished with you, you'll no longer be yourself.
Remember everything.
Remembering everything doesn't mean you know everything.
Tell me.
You've just been hacked. Could be worse than Snowden.
Facial recognition got a hit.
Jesus Christ, that's Jason Bourne.
Why would he come back now?
There's a demonstration in front of the Greek Parliament building. I think she'll use it as cover.
They tracked you. We gotta move. This is Jason Bourne.
I need to talk.
32 kills. People are safer because of what you did. Never gonna find any peace, not till you admit to yourself who you really are.
All right, so Jason Bourne, of course, is the actual fifth Jason Bourne movie, but the fourth to feature Jason Bourne himself. Like, it's the fifth Bourne movie, but the fourth to feature Jason Bourne.
That is correct. Right? You crack the math on that one. It's getting harder and harder with these bigger franchises, but yes, that is correct.
I feel like a beautiful mind, to be honest with you. So this one is back on the program. This time is Paul Greengrass and Matt Damon. This time it's been a decade since they made a movie and a decade since Matt Damon walked away and went into the shadows and had to go through his wilding thing of sitting and getting in shirtless fights to find himself, which is basically what Jason Bourne does in this movie. He is now 10 years later and he ends up running into Nikki Parsons, his former, played by, what's her name?
Julia Stiles.
Julia Stiles, yes. Julia Stiles, who basically, she's kind of a hacker now, and she discovers that a fact about his past, because we're always trying to figure out Jason Bourne's past, because he forgot it. So we're now in like our fourth movie for him. We keep getting pieces of the puzzle. As it turns out, this puts him back into contact with the CIA director Robert Dewey, who's played by Tommy Lee Jones, and his fellow big shot there at the CIA, Heather Lee, played by Alicia Vikander. And it turns out that they end up, while he's also being chased by an assassin with a grudge, played by Vincent Cassel, basically, Jason Bourne's back. He's kicking ass. He's trying to figure out who he is. That's pretty much summed it up. And it summed up one of the many problems I had with this movie. Because to be very clear, Grierson, you and I both love the Bourne movies, particularly the Greengrass movies. But I really love the Paul Greengrass Bourne movies. I think it's probably fair to say I'm a Greengrass honk.
You do like him. I mean, I like him a lot as well. But you also, you know, obviously, United 93 and Captain Phillips as well. I don't think either of us.
United 93. Yeah, United 93 is one of the best. Like, it's one of my favorite movies of the last 20 years. So, like, I love the guy. And I love, you know, and it's funny because one of the things that's really kind of fascinating about this movie and I find it ultimately kind of depressing about it is how kind of crusty it feels already. A lot of the things that felt very innovative, kind of the quick cutting, the handheld cam stuff, feels a little hackneyed here. It feels a little, you know, we forget with the Bourne movies, after the two sequels that Greengrass did, there was this thought that, man, how are they going to do a James Bond movie now? like the whole notion was he had reinvented this kind of like international intrigue, spy thriller kind of thing. And what's funny is it's only been 9 years. It's not that been long. There's been another Bourne movie since then, even though it wasn't by Greengrass and didn't have Matt Damon. It's amazing how it feels kind of rote and even a little tired, which was a little surprising to me. And it wouldn't bother me so much, except for the fact that this story is, it feels like a greatest hits thing of best Bourne movies, which is fine. You know, I understand they're trying to get this franchise back on track. That's generally the idea. It appears that financially they have in fact done that. But the whole thing that I loved about these movies is they always felt of the moment. They always felt very urgent. You know, one of the things I love about Greengrass is he's able to take, you know, a basic, you know, potboiler and attach it to a real life event and make it feel real through handheld, through kind of the quick cutting, through just like makes them feel urgent and of the moment, and like they're happening in the real world. That's what I love about the Bourne movies, is they feel they are these big action spectacles, but they feel like they are existing in our current universe. And there's a little bit of that here, but all of it feels a little phoned in. There's like a obvious, you know, public privacy versus safety subplot, which basically is just a fake Google type company, and people saying Snowden a lot is pretty much how that plot comes in. And even Matt Damon's character, like Jason Bourne's never been like the, I mean, he's never been like this fully realized character, but there's certainly been some intrigue to him. It's amazing how much he feels like Jack Bauer now. Like Jack, if you ever watched 24, Jack Bauer by like season 4 was no longer a character. He was the Terminator essentially. And there are times in this movie where Jason Bourne not only feels like the Terminator, but feels like a plot construction in his own movie. So listen, you're talking to someone who loves Paul Greengrass movies and loves all of the Bourne movies. I was pretty depressed by how little I like Jason Bourne.
Yeah, the disappointment for me was there, but I would say less. This is the weakest of the Matt Damon Paul Greengrass Bourne movies. And it does kind of, what I sort of thought when I watched it was, this movie kind of goes through the motions expertly. I do think that they do their thing that they did in the first three Bourne movies pretty well. But there's nothing in this movie that tops anything that they've done before. And certain moments in this movie, things that are like the big highlights, actually actively recall earlier, better moments from earlier movies. I think for me, I don't want to defend this movie too strenuously, but I do think that it is a pretty well-made, pretty well-put-together action thriller. For me, what keeps it from being really great partly is what you say, but I also think partly, especially what's hard in this series, is that that original trilogy kind of completed itself and found a natural, organic ending in such a good way that this movie kind of doesn't need to exist, and they can't figure out a way to make, like, basically justify its existence. The two ways they do is saying, oh, we have more information about your past, and there is now, and this to me always drives me crazy, and it was mentioned a lot during The Force Awakens, which is essentially for the Bourne movies, there is an elaborate intelligence operation. There was one in the original trilogy, and Jason Bourne had to kind of like figure it out and break it down. And now there's a new one, and it's even more powerful and terrifying than the last one. So it's kind of like they had one Death Star that Jason Bourne blew up. They have now built another Death Star, and he has to go blow this one up now. And so both of those components make it really hard to be as emotionally invested in this one. I know that a lot of people think that Matt Damon just kind of sleepwalks through this one. I actually don't find that to be much of a problem. The thing I do like about this one is that the movie, I think, actually acknowledges the fact that he is older, and even more than, say, Bourne Ultimatum, which was the third one in the series. There, I think there is an attempt to basically acknowledge the fact that, listen, this guy's in his 40s now. He's not nearly the ass-kicking machine that he was before. He gets beat up a little bit more. He has kind of a tougher time kind of doing things. I mean, yes, he can still punch people and knock them down with a single punch, but there,
yeah, that's there's that,
but there's still, I think, as he's going on through the actual like fight scenes, there's more of an attempt to make him seem a little bit more human. I actually think Alicia Vikander is quite great in this movie. I think she's really fun. I think she's the best part of this movie because she's, I think, the one element of this film that feels really, really alive and new and fun. Essentially, she's the Joan Allen of this movie. But I do think that she's different than the Joan Allen character. And I found
her. There's an ambition to her that I kind of liked in this movie.
Yeah, and there's an arc to her, right, too, I would say. Right. I think that the way the finale that it builds to is actually really nice, though there is sort of the kind of obligatory, let's set this thing up for sequels. There's also an element of where that character goes that you're not necessarily expecting. I had a fine time watching this, I had to say. I don't think it's great, but to me it's fun enough that I was able to enjoy it.
You know, I did a lot of balancing while watching this. And am I disappointed because this movie isn't that good, or am I disappointed because the other movies are so good? And I think it's a little bit of both, but I would say it's a little bit more. There's just not a lot of passion in this. And Greengrass, that's his thing. Even a movie like Captain Phillips, and again, you know how much I love Captain Phillips, but one of the great things about Captain Phillips too is it's actually not just about a guy get on a boat getting kidnapped. It's basically the much discussed, but I think really kind of vital little bookends to that movie, particularly the kind of opening section, is really all about how the great joke about both the captain and the people that kidnapped him is they are all just cogs in this machine. They are all really just playing the same kind of helpless roles in this corporate global world. And all there's that kind of feel that all of these movies had, and one of the things that's really surprised, like that both Bourne movies had too, the great, you know, the awesomeness of that great car chase scene in New York in the third movie is it also ties into the just chaos that the movie kind of is trying to capture. And then like the Bourne stuff's going on, but it also feels like the world's collapsing around them and everything is chaotic and no one knows who's on what side and there's just madness everywhere. Here it just feels like, oh, we have to have an action sequence that tops that one. And there's a big thing, there's no thematic element. There's a big scene in Las Vegas where, again, I'm always impressed at like, hey, how did they get the casinos to like agree to let them crash the car? In a lot of ways, I'm always kind of impressed anytime any anyone can do a Vegas scene in that way. But there's no overarching. There's like nods to Grease and nods to protesters in the street. But basically, you know, in a way that like they felt real and organic in other Greengrass movies, in this, it just feels like, you know, what's the movie that you saw at Cannes, the Sean Penn one that everybody hated?
I'm happy to say the memory of that movie. Oh, The Last Face. Yeah, the title had escaped me completely. Yes, The Last Face. Yes.
Yeah, and like, you know, I've not seen it, but one of the criticisms of that movie was that they had this story going on in the foreground and that the actual story was going on all around them, and the movie didn't seem to notice that. And what's funny about this is, you know, it feels like this obligatory, oh, we're in Greece, there's a protest going on, so there's your socio-political element that you've gotten used to in these Bourne movies. But it doesn't actually care what that protest is or what's going on with it at all. And it made me realize just how little thought had gone into this one compared to the thought that had gone into the last one. I agree with you on Vikander that she's really good, first off. But also, she is, you're not sure whose side she's on even by the end of the movie, you're not even sure what side she's on. So she is an interesting kind of character, but that's the only real wild card they've thrown into this.
Yeah, I again, I don't want to defend the movie too much. I think a couple things. Number one, I think this is a better version of the other Matt Damon, Paul Greengrass collaboration, Green Zone.
Because that movie is worse than this.
Yeah, because Green Zone's big problem was it tried to be a Bourne movie, but really, really, really thought it was telling you something. And I found that to be really off-putting in that movie. I would prefer, and these are terrible choices to select between, but I would prefer a movie like Jason Bourne where, to your point about it being kind of like, oh, Grease, Snowden, and other relevant social topics inserted here. I would rather have that as a sort of a pithy excuse to move the story forward than using that as the big overall point. I prefer this movie because it is escapist, and I agree that some of this stuff doesn't work. Though I will say that the kind of the globe-trotting element of this movie that has always been part of the Bourne movies, having those things in the background didn't bother me so much because to me there was a bit of a sense of Bourne's been gone this long, the world hasn't changed. He actually didn't fix anything. He didn't make anything better. This stuff is still going on. Now, that is not a profound point or an amazing point, but I at least thought that was at least more interesting than a full force. Like to me, like I think Riz Ahmed is really good as that character, but the problem is that character is such a boring Hollywood, like Steve Jobs-esque figure that they always use in these types of things. And that, to me, I think is much more like hackneyed and kind of obvious. Because movies like this, that kind of lecture you about privacy concerns and like that, studios don't really care about that because they want to get their movies out as many places. The only thing they're concerned about in terms of privacy is basically piracy. That's really the only thing that they worry about. And so right. It's always kind of cute when they say that. For me, the original Bourne trilogy, though there is also the element of government surveillance and how much is the government kind of encroaching into our lives, that was clearly there. But I have to say, it's always very funny, that was never the thing that really got me in those movies. What got me was the sense of this guy who woke up, didn't know who he was, and slowly, because he was Matt Damon and was a very sympathetic figure, slowly discovers, oh, I'm this like awful killing machine. And you don't think that he's that type of person, and he doesn't think he is either, and he realizes that at one point he was. And that gave those movies this really emotional component. That is not so much here. That is actually the thing I sort of miss the most in this movie. I will say, though, for me, like the Vegas thing at the end, I kind of loved. It's completely over the top, but I actually thought it was really, it doesn't top anything before in like the earlier movies, but it's pretty damn fun. And I actually did get a kick out of it. So
I just, and again, this may come back to me just like taking those first movies too seriously, but to me, like, there's so much, hey, this is fun. This is over the top. That's not what I go to Bourne movies for. Right. That's not really what I felt for them before. And I think, and particularly, that's not why I go to Paul Greengrass movies. And so for me, that was the hard part for me to kind of get my head around, is how this was not only comfortable with being just your regular Hollywood blockbuster, but never really even strive to be much beyond that.
Yeah, this movie is so comfortable being kind of that type of Hollywood blockbuster that Tommy Lee Jones plays Tommy Lee Jones in this movie. Like, he's basically like the bad guy, and he's kind of the Tommy Lee Jones type. There's not really an attempt to kind of make him interesting or anything like that. And I also thought Vincent Cassell was just kind of meh as the assassin on the path.
And both really good actors. Like, both really good actors who can give a lot of shit. And particularly Cassell, because there's a scene where, like, you see him looking in the mirror, kind of, and you realize kind of the pain, because his character apparently is spent time in prison being tortured because of something that Jason Bourne had done. And there's a moment where you're like, oh, we're going to get, like, into this character and see what drives him. Nope. He's just going to come and kill me.
And the one other thing I wanted to throw in, I think that has not been talked about enough, because again, I do like the movie, but I admit its weaknesses. I think the thing that people have not talked about enough about why this movie isn't as strong is it doesn't have Gilroy, who directed the Bourne movie that had Jeremy Renner and had written other installments. And instead you have Paul Greengrass writing it, who I don't think is a very strong writer. And you also have the film's editor, who this is like his like first screenplay, Christopher Rouse. Just on a script level, it just sort of feels like it doesn't have the kind of thought through process that made the earlier movies as strong as they were. Because I think Greengrass does his thing pretty well. I just don't think he has the foundation for, on a screenplay level, to really kind of rise up to make this kind of worthy of the movies that came before it.
All right, so Grayson, what did you ultimately end up giving it?
I gave it my most common grade this summer. I gave it a B.
Yeah, I gave it a C. I actually found it, I found it more of a step away from what I liked about the original franchise, frankly, than the Gilroy Jeremy Renner movie. I felt like that was actually more in keeping with it than this was, and so therefore I was pretty disappointed. This is now my second. Again, I am a Greengrass honk across the board, but I think this is the second one of his movies, along with Green Zone, that I've not liked.
Yeah, and I think we both agree this is still better than Green Zone, though.
Yes, oh, it is definitely better than Green Zone. That movie is terrible. And it's funny, too, because all I wanted in the world, like, come on, you remember when that movie came out? All I wanted in the world was a great Paul Greengrass movie about how awful that war was. And nope, did not turn out the way. It was also a few years late. I think it was delayed a couple of times, too.
Yeah, I think that was kind of the case. I think it also just sort of felt like, okay, yeah, we sort of already know all this stuff, guys. Yeah. So,
it was like after No End in Sight, and it just felt like, yeah, it didn't really feel. But so we encourage everyone to go see the original Bourne movies, or just go see United 93 again. It is one of my favorite movies of a very long time. And hey, a really happy, fun time at the movies.
Yes, absolutely.
All right, so now that is our main review this week. Now we kick into our reboot section. We have two movies in our reboot section. And our first movie we kick it off with is Quiz Show.
How are you, Herb? How's everything in Queens?
Fine, Mr. Barry.
Now, there's a face.
Nervous strain
in
the family.
Stemple is an underdog.
I don't think he works anymore.
No, Herb, it's a hell of a thing. I'm looking at the thing today. But you plateaued.
I waited 29 years for this. Now, I'm supposed to take a dive.
Quiz Show came out in 1994, a banner year, I think, actually, in Hollywood movies. This was directed by Robert Redford and stars John Turturro, Rob Murrow, Ray Fiennes, David Paymer, Paul Scofield, Hank Azaria, the indisputably wonderful Christopher McDonald. And it's based on the quiz show scandals of the 1950s, a game show called 21, which was the biggest game show in America back when there were only like three channels in the world. And people would tune in across the country to watch this live quiz show where two people would compete against each other. And for quite some time, this man who's played by John Turturro, a guy from Queens, was the champion. Basically, the bigwigs at the studio decided, we need to get rid of this guy. Herb Stemple is not really a face that's made for television. And they were looking and looking and looking for somebody who'd be more appealing. Well, out of the blue comes Charles Van Doren, played by Ray Fiennes, who's part of the very famous Van Doren family. There's a couple times in the movie when people are referring to Charles Van Doren, they say of the Van Dorens, because they were that big of a family back then. Charles Van Doren is a writer, a historian, but also wanted to do quiz shows. He found them really interesting. And so the producers of the show conspire with him to cheat, essentially, so that he can always win because the ratings keep going up because people want to see him on television. Now, I mentioned that this was sort of a banner year, 1994. In terms of Best Picture nominees, because a lot, and this was back in the days when there were only five nominees, and this year especially, I think was a really, really strong year because you had Quiz Show, you had Forrest Gump, which won, you had Pulp Fiction, you had Shawshank Redemption, also Four Weddings and a Funeral, don't forget that.
Mm-hmm. And that was another movie that came out.
Yes, and that was ding. And then, of course, the best movie of 1994, which was Hoop Dreams, which did not get nominated for Best Picture. I have not seen Quiz Show in its entirety in, I'm going to say, 2 decades. How about you, Will? When was the last time you actually saw Quiz Show?
It was when we saw it. Then and I, we both loved this movie. You loved it even a little bit more than I did.
Well,
we both were incredibly fond.
Yeah, we both made both of our top tens in 1994. When we did our top 10 movies of the 1990s, it made my list as well. So I was both excited and slightly nervous to go back and watch this movie, I have to say. And I guess I'll just go first. This movie to me doesn't entirely hold up as amazingly as I thought it did back then. I still think it is really, really good. There are some things I do want to talk about that I don't like as much in this movie now when I watch it. But the thing I am most impressed now watching this movie that really kind of stays with me is this is the type of movie that we get maybe three or four of maybe a year now, where it's a studio movie based on a true story, has sort of a Oscar prestige picture. It's about things. It's supposed to be about America and certain things about America. And this is a really well-made version of that kind of movie. I think it's exceptionally smart. Back when I was in film school, the screenplay was written by Paul Attanasio. And I actually remember reading this script at film school after the movie had come out. And I was so incredibly impressed, just as a piece of writing, just how good it is. And I remember at that time, Attanasio was kind of on everybody's like wish list in terms of adapting things and like that. I think he wrote Sphere after this, unfortunately, that Barry Sonnenfeld film.
He did do Donnie Brasco.
He did do Donnie Brasco, which is great. And he then did a lot of television afterwards.
He's House. He's basically
House. And he's kind of transitioned to that.
Former film critic, by the way.
That's right. Those hacks. Those
jerks. He was film critic for the Washington Post in like the 80s.
And I think that this is an example of a movie that I think is better written than directed. I think it is directed quite well, but to me, this movie is all about its screenplay and all about these rich characters that Attanasio has created. Now, of course, credit where it's due to Robert Redford in terms of working with this cast. I think the cast, kind of from top to bottom, is really strong. There are a couple people that kind of bug me.
But
for the most part, it is very exciting to watch this movie now, because this is not a movie when they make like best movies of the last 25 year lists. This one rarely shows up. It's kind of been forgotten about. And one of the reasons why I think it's been forgotten is that it is not a movie that is necessarily scintillating filmmaking or groundbreaking filmmaking. I mean, just the fact that it was up against Pulp Fiction, which is, of course, now an iconic movie. Quiz Show is a little more staid in certain ways. But I think that what's fun to watch about this movie now is to see somebody like Ralph Fiennes in particular, to see Ralph Fiennes at that early stage in his career when it really seemed like not only was he a great actor, but this movie reminds you that he was kind of looked at as almost like a golden god, to be honest. And he works so well in this role specifically because of that reason. Like everybody in America with Charles Van Doren, you kind of can't stop looking at the guy because he's just so beautiful. I mean, he almost has like a Lawrence of Arabia, Peter O'Toole kind of quality about him in this movie. And it's also a great reminder of what I think he as an actor has done kind of throughout his career, which is play these characters who are either really handsome or very sophisticated or both, but have this darker side to them. And I think from an early stage in his career, even to something like a bigger splash this year, he has been able to use that dichotomy really, really nicely in his performances. There are a lot of lines that I remember from this movie from back in 1994. The father-son element, I think, is really strong. The idea about specifically Jews versus Gentiles and kind of the tension between those two worlds, I think is actually really nicely done in this movie. I've talked enough. I'm actually really curious, well, what you thought about it, but those are my opening thoughts about watching this movie again.
Yeah, it is so well constructed and well thought through. You're right. It's almost like a granular level, organic, like how it was created. It just feels, it really understands and knows these people, particularly the Van Dorens. I think the real heart of the movie is, I think, the father-son of the Van Dorens. I think that is actually, and it's funny because that feels, it's funny, it connects to the part of the movie that I don't know if it holds up as well, which is, look what television has done to us.
Bingo, yes.
Which I do not think really works or holds up that well. That feels a little Robert Redford kind of pointing his finger at me or wagging his finger at me and letting me know that I've done something wrong. That's also the one part for, it's funny because a movie that, of course, is about things that happened in the 50s, that feels very dated now. It feels like this notion of Robert Redford saying, careful, television's not what you seem. Don't get lost with that. And it just feels so kind of old and kind of silly in a lot of ways. Along those lines, one, you talked about the actors in the movie and everybody holding up. I'd actually forgotten that Rob Morrow was in this movie.
as do most people, yes.
I'd forgotten that Rob Morrow was in this movie, and he's fine, but Turturro and Fiennes and almost everybody else are so good that Morrow starts to feel like an accent after a while, even down to the small characters. Chris McDonald is obviously great in the lead as the host of the show. You know, I forgot how great Hank Azaria is in this movie. Hey, there's that little stretch where Hank Azaria in the 90s, when he was getting out from The Simpsons and showing that he wasn't just a comic guy. Well, he's so versatile, and he's kind of this very compelling, entertaining asshole in this movie. I love the relationship with him and David Paymer. They're both really, really good. And I found myself going more and more toward those characters and more about the connection between the father and the son, and a lot less to Rob Morrow and his ambition. And I think there's something kind of interesting in the idea that he is also charmed by Charles Van Doren the way that we are, and therefore wants to cut him some slack. Mira Sorvino in a very small thankless role still has a couple nice little moments and reminded me of that time, like, oh yeah, there's this up and coming actress that's about to even at the time I thought she was gonna, of course this was around the time of Monty Aphrodite, so she was, you know, she was this up and coming, she's really kind of good in her small little thankless role. But in kind of like calling him out on, you're giving him so much credit. You are transfixed by him as everybody else is, which is good. But I feel like that's a point the movie is already kind of making. I found the relationship between the father and son a lot more compelling. And a lot of the Rob Morrow stuff, I find myself drifting a little bit, to be entirely honest. But so much stuff. And Turturro is so great. Turturro is great in this. But it really is a Ralph Fiennes movie. And I feel pretty strong. I still feel very, I like this movie probably just as much as I did then. There's just a couple things that I had to take a couple steps back from.
Yeah, the thing that is interesting about this movie, again, it came out in 1994. This movie is both ahead of its time and also kind of dated now in the same way, because I do think this idea that in some ways it points the direction forward for what's going to happen with reality television, and the idea that audiences are watching because they think it's real, but we behind the scenes are actually manufacturing that reality, because this movie predates The Truman Show, which is also very much about that. I think is still a stronger movie because of that. But on that level, it's kind of like prescient. The problem is that now we watch this and go, this is not news. And also, the movie is also kind of proud of itself for not being television. And especially watching this movie now, what's funny, or at least for me while I was watching it, is like, but everybody likes television now. Now, reality programming and crap like that, no, they don't like that. But now that we're kind of in this golden age of television, parts of this movie's, I think, superiority to television doesn't wash, because now television, frankly, a movie like Quiz Show would probably be on HBO now. I mean, yeah. You know, so like that element is actually kind of funny.
Directed by Jay Roach. No offense to Jay Roach, who I like. He was just in the Culture
Vulture. I was just going to say, yes. But yeah, no, it would be. And it would seem like, again, like it's like a true story. That would be an HBO, like a well-made HBO movie now. Rob Morrow is interesting to me in this movie, because I agree that he is not as strong as an actor or as a role as these other people are in this movie. But it actually works in the movie's advantage, I think, because there is a certain element of this idea of watching this movie where I think, yeah, the Rob Murrows in the world, nobody is going to remember them. They're going to remember the guy who was the big quiz show winner. They're going to remember the guy who accused the big quiz show winner and the whole quiz show of cheating, you know, the Herbert Stimple character. But the Rob Murrows, who are just like the investigators, they kind of fade into the ether. Nobody remembers them. And so in some ways, having Murrow play that character is actually kind of perfect. So I love that you said, Will, that you kind of forgot that he was in this movie. Because I actually think it worked. Actually, I don't think this was intentional, but it actually adds weight to the idea of history being written by the winners in a certain way, or kind of the more kind of glamorous people, because it's the Charles Van Dorens that we remember. I completely agree with you, by the way. The stuff with Paul Scofield is fabulous. After all this time, I still remember, because there's like a thing in this movie where he and his son trade Shakespeare lines back and forth, and that final one that they have in the classroom, and he says, "You have my name." I still remember that. Scofield is a guy who's sort of like kind of like larger than life figure, and so he's sort of perfect as that father. I think for me, Will also is very, very strong, and why I think Murrow's character does work in this movie is a lot of this film is also kind of about envy or this idea of the grass being greener somewhere else. And I also really like in the father-son dynamic that even the father, to a certain extent, though he doesn't outright say it, there is a little part of me that feels like the father thinks, why is my son getting all of this attention for this thing?
And it's
nicely done, as opposed to lines like, I thought I was going to get TV, turns out TV is going to get us, which is really, really, really tough. You know, and also, and maybe I was the last idiot for this to dawn on, watching this time, I thought, oh, Robert Redford made his own All the President's Men while watching this movie, because this movie is about a certain amount of investigation. Of course, there's like a happy ending at the end of All the President's Men. There really isn't in this one, but it is kind of about just the work of doing investigative, like journalism, essentially, to kind of crack a story and see what's sort of going on and exposing corruption and like that. It's not as strong as I remember. But in terms of it being forgotten, I think it actually it sort of deserves a second. I also think it looks great, by the way. Michael Bauhaus shot it. I think it looks wonderful. All the quiz show elements are really exciting and really fun. And I think a big part of the enjoyment of this movie is just watching how the quiz show works. I think it actually is really, really fun, the way it sort of is put together. So yeah, I was really happy to kind of go back and have the excuse to revisit this movie.
Okay, a couple of things to wrap up with us. Two things. One, I'd forgotten about the era where Martin Scorsese was acting.
Oh, he's so good in this movie.
He's really good.
He's really good.
He's really, really good in this movie. As the accountant, as basically a guy that works for... Has he worked for Geritol?
Yeah, he's the big Geritol guy, essentially, yes.
Yeah, and he's just fantastic. There was a little stretch where he was in Guilty by Suspicion, and he was in the Kurosawa movie.
Yes, yes.
There's a stretch where he was actually acting a little bit. But I'm looking through his IMDb right now. He, other than playing himself or playing cameos in his own movies, he actually never acted again after this, which is kind of...
Yeah, he did like a voice in Shark Tale, I think. I think that was sort of like... Yeah.
I don't think that counts.
Yeah, for me, what I enjoy is that, for me, Redford and Scorsese are always connected because of 1980. Redford wins for Ordinary People beating Raging Bull. So I would have loved to have known if there was any conversations about that. Anyway, go ahead.
Yeah, because he has his son won by then either. And the last thing, too, is it's fun to spot the, oh, look who that person, look who that small actor turned out to be. Always fun in these movies. I think we had this with Maya Rudolph in Gattaca. This is a fun one. Calista Flockhart?
Yes. Ding.
Mario Cantone,
mm-hmm.
And Ethan Hawke.
Ethan Hawke, who had been in certain things, but was not.
Yes. But he's a walk on. He like you would. He doesn't get a close up of his face. You have to look really close to even notice that's him.
And also, I had forgotten that Barry Levinson. Speaking of directors turned actors, Barry Levinson is in this as well.
Hey, this is one of the best movies starring directors, not playing directors, of all time. I'll certainly give it that. So that is Quiz Show. I was, regardless of whatever qualms I may have had with it, very, very happy to revisit this movie.
Which now brings us to a movie that I had shockingly never seen before, a Chevy Chase comedy called Fletch.
Ah, for God, Don. What is this man saying? What is this man doing?
What in the hell's the matter with you?
What is this man's name?
My name is Igor Stravinsky.
Hi there, I'm Harry S. Truman.
I'm Don Corleone.
They call him Fletch.
Fletch! Fletch!
Fletch, F. Fletch.
He's good at defending himself.
You better tie your shoelaces.
Yes, Fletch came out in 1985, directed by Michael Ritchie, based off the novel by Gregory MacDonald, written by Andrew Bergman. Actually, this is a series of novels that Gregory MacDonald, they're kind of crime novels. Looking back around this movie, I didn't realize that they were actually very well critically received novels. I always imagined them as like a Lee Child, Jack Reacher type of thing, but they actually, at least the first couple, were very well received critically. This, of course, stars Chevy Chase as basically a journalist. He is a journalist. He works for a newspaper. He works for a Los Angeles newspaper. This is, of course, during a time where journalists just wrote like one story every 3 weeks, maybe, and most of the time just sat and drank and hung out, which is, I guess, was the thing at the time. It's a different profession now. But he plays this journalist who is investigating basically a drug ring among the homeless people in Los Angeles, including George Wendt, by the way, is a very unconvincing homeless person, and ends up a man played by Tim Matheson finds him and offers him $50,000 to kill him. And so therefore then Fletch goes out to realizes, hey, this thing weird about this, starts to research his life, starts to investigate, and basically ambles his way into this, I wouldn't call it a conspiracy as much as all sorts of criminal goings on in the Los Angeles network. And meanwhile, Fletch is there right at the middle of every single scene. He's a sports fan. He's a raconteur. He likes the ladies. He dresses up in a lot of disguises, which seems to be the fundamental gimmick to the movie, is that there are many times where you see Chevy Chase dressed up like someone other than Chevy Chase. So now it's funny. I was looking through after seeing the movie, I was looking through, because again, I'd never seen it, and I knew it was popular. I remember the time where Kevin Smith wanted to do one of these. I think Jason Sudeikis has said playing Fletch is like something he really wants to do at some point in his career. It's like one of his goals to make a Fletch movie. I suspect that the novel is actually pretty good. It's probably a good little crime novel. There's probably a lot of good little crime novels in the Fletch universe. I can't find those good crime novels very well in this movie, to be entirely honest, because listen, if there were ever a referendum on Chevy Chase, like where do you fit on Chevy Chase? Because I like my personal favorite Chevy Chase performance is the original Vacation movie. I think he's actually very charming. He's very fun. I like the Christmas Vacation movie too. I like a Chevy Chase that's generally kind of humbled and put upon, because I think it goes against what Chevy Chase actually is and certainly sees himself as. This movie is so much Chevy Chase. It's so much unchecked Chevy Chase that if you don't like Chevy Chase, and I should be as clear as possible on this, I do not like Chevy Chase. If you don't like Chevy Chase, you're going to have a super hard problem with this movie. Because, listen, I'm sure this is a good, again, as I said, these are probably very good crime novels. They seem very interesting. You can tell there's a nougat of a story in there. Some of the narration actually reads kind of like lovely, well-written, like it's probably from the book. It seems like it's probably a well-written book. But this really is a movie that gives Chevy Chase an excuse to be at the middle of every scene and do a bunch of Chevy Chase things. And I just frankly didn't find very many of them funny at all. There are proctology jokes. There are, hey, doctors, a lot of them are Jewish jokes. There is it's strange to me to even watch this movie and think that there was a time that Chevy Chase was a movie star. I mean, he's handsome. I think he's conventionally handsome, which is probably why he was with the original star to kind of pop out of the SNL scene. But that character, there's no movement to him. There's no empathy to him at all. He just kind of is kind of in his own world as the other movie is going around him, finding himself frankly a lot more charming than I think the rest of us find him. It is possible that Chevy Chase's humor is the exact opposite of mine. So keep that in mind when I discuss Fletch. But I have to say, I found Fletch a pretty miserable sit.
I had teased last week on the podcast, I had never seen this movie. So I was actually very excited to check it out. I basically loathed it from the first second. I'm not even sure where to begin. I think you actually kind of encapsulated it nicely. I also am not a Chevy Chase person. And while watching it, I actually thought to myself, because I do this in general with movies, whether they are older movies or movies out now. If it's not working for me, I really try to put myself into the movie's kind of mindset and go, okay, let me just sort of see what this is about, what's going on, how I'm supposed to feel, how I'm supposed to react to this. I think I've said before on this on the podcast, I think when we were doing Married to the Mob, I think I mentioned this. You know, there's this new Ghostbusters out. And so there's been kind of this referendum on the old Ghostbusters. Is it actually a great movie? Should it be considered a classic? All this stuff. I actually think the original Ghostbusters is really, really funny. I really like that movie quite a lot. But that being said, a lot of movies that are considered sort of classic 80s comedies, I really despise. And this movie is almost like a perfect encapsulation of all the things I hate in 80s comedies. That's when that score starts, and then like the opening credits, I seriously thought I was watching this on my Kindle, and I thought, I'm not going to throw this right now because I don't want to break this thing. But I was like, that's it. I'm out. I'm out already. But yeah.
It's also a really bad video. Like, if it would be better if it were a video game score. Like, it feels like I'll be pushing Mario around. This is going to be on repeat for like 5 hours as I try to get Mario to World 5.1.
Yeah. One of the things I really did enjoy this weekend, by the way, was playing for my wife all the different songs in the movie, like the classic Get Out of Town, which is used during the freeway chase and like that. I think you put it really well, Will, about what is good about how Chevy Chase can work in a movie, because I also think Vacation's pretty fabulous. This is one of those movies where we are to believe that everybody, not only there are certain people in a movie that find anything that Chevy Chase says utterly charming, and then another group of people that will fall for anything, apparently, because like he has disguises and they're kind of dumb and whatever. That's fine. My big problem with this movie is I'm like, okay, so wait. So this guy is a reporter, and so he goes undercover a lot and assumes these disguises and then uses the stupidest, most obvious names that nobody questions, and then doesn't ever seem to know anything about the world he operates in, and no one seems to question him on it. Now, this is a comedy, and I get it. You're not supposed to be, like, deeply highly realistic, but on, like, a simple, like, surface level, I went, this is, like, the luckiest guy on the face of the earth. Why has he been murdered, like, 12 times during this movie?
Yes.
It's also, you know, it's an election year. There's a lot of conversation about political correctness. You know, you've written about political correctness somewhat recently yourself, Will. And I'm sympathetic to an idea that, you know, being too sensitive is too much. But at the same time, watching this movie, I kept thinking, there are so many homophobic jokes. There are so many just like dashed off jokes about junkies and homeless people, and you know, it's like and Jewish people. And even like when Fletch is having his fantasy sequence of playing basketball with Kareem and he's got like an afro, I'm like, what is this? I mean, I don't think I'm some sort of like, you know, wilting, like, you know, I'm not part of the nanny state where I need to be like, you know, tended to at all times. But I'm like, this isn't funny. This is like actually like kind of like borderline offensive. Or put it this way, it's not funny enough to push back against the fact that it might be borderline offensive. And the movie is just kind of stacked with this from beginning to end. I found the story pretty just like boring, other than the fact like, you know, that he hires him to kill him and he wonders what's kind of going on. There's a couple twists, whatever. You know, the love interest, who's played by Dana Wheeler Nicholson, I felt so bad for her. I wanted her to escape as quickly as possible.
Oh, for what it's worth, forget her. I felt bad for Gina Davis.
Yes, I knew you were gonna...
Gina Davis is in this movie, playing like I guess his beautiful assistant, his girl Friday, basically,
yeah.
And has to like not only do everything for him and basically do all the reporting, of course, that he gets credit for. But just look at him with just like the most adoring eyes. And I'm like, man, this woman, like, you could see this woman was going to become a great actress because if she could do this, and she's actually like, some of that comes across. There's actually some legitimate Gina Davis charm in this movie. But man, oh man, what a thankless girl. This was her second movie after Tootsie.
For me, what's amazing is because I had never watched the movie, I kept thinking, so they're going to fall for each other at the end, right? And when they don't, I'm like, that poor woman, she was like, she was so devoted to him. And he's just like,
no, she dodged a bullet, man.
Yeah, no, I'm hoping, I don't know what happens in the sequel Fletch Lives, but hopefully she's moved on and she doesn't need him anymore. I mean,
Can I say I hope that in the sequel Fletch dies? Can I say that?
It's excruciating. We've talked about, like, again, not to always compare things to Gymkhana. Gymkhana is so much easier to sit through. This movie is actually,
I agree.
Because this movie, he's so proud of himself for how smart he is, how funny he is. And like, there's so many like things that he clearly ad-libbed that were just like, what? Like, stop mumbling, Chevy Chase. I can't hear what you're even saying anyway. God, I hated this movie. I really hated this movie. If whoever remakes this, like, I also remember Jason Sudeikis wanting to remake it. I feel like you and me, Will, we have a free weekend. We knock out a script for this. We direct it. Neither of us have any directing experience whatsoever. I'm going to go on record. We can make a better Fletch movie than this movie. That's my bold proclamation for episode 28 of this podcast.
Also, this was a hit.
I know.
Like, not only was it a hit, people liked it. Like, this got good reviews.
Yes, yes. You know, this is not gonna replace anybody's mind. Airplane as best Kareem Abdul-Jabbar performance. Yeah.
It's upsetting. I was really surprised how bad it was. Because, and again, I like the idea of, I'm a sucker for a comedian doing the slightly more serious role or playing. I'm a sucker for it. I am. And I thought maybe this is what it was, because it was such a well-regarded series of novels. Like, this was like him like moving in that direction a little bit. And then I cannot believe, like, Gregory MacDonald, the guy that wrote the books, apparently said he turned down Burt Reynolds and Mick Jagger, but was okay with Chevy Chase. I cannot believe that the guy that wrote the plot of these movies and created this character and wrote like 10 novels about them, I can't believe he was okay with it.
And also along those lines, like, the legend is that he'd actually never seen Chevy Chase perform before. So it's like, wait.
Obviously not.
my two final things is that, you know, I'm always open to the idea that a comedy that, you know, a main character who's kind of a jerk, that there can be like this kind of like this edgy sort of sharp elbowed kind of humor that comes from that. I just find this movie completely unfunny and him just loathsome as a character. So it doesn't even work on that level. And the other thing is that I actually like, whether it's Chinatown or The Long Goodbye or even, say, like Maltese Falcon, this idea, more Chinese or more Chinatown and I guess Long Goodbye, this idea of the wised up L.A. detective, almost kind of like a revisionist thing of the old kind of gumshoe mystery thriller types of things. But this movie is just terrible. I just, like, if we got Long Goodbye and Chinatown in the 1970s, and those movies kind of reflected the sort of anti-conformist counterculture world of the 1970s, then Fletch is kind of perfect for the 80s because it just sucks and is cynical and lame and stupid, and I hate it. I hated this movie. I apologize. The person who wrote the very nice review, I felt bad all 94 minutes watching this movie because this nice man wrote us a very nice review, and I'm
telling me hate his movie. I have to say, this is, I'm with you. We're, you know, we've got a lot of movies coming up to do in our reboot list, and we've obviously mocked Gymkhana a lot on there. This is the worst movie we've done in reboot so far. Do you agree?
Yes, because it is worse than Married to the Mob. So yes, I agree with that. But we have some fun ones coming up in the future. So that title may be usurped here very soon.
Yes. Well, that leads us to our preview of next week's episode, Grace. Because if we go on Fletch any longer, like, my microphone's gonna start melting. So next week, we will be talking. We have one big signature review next week. It is Suicide Squad, the big DC. The bad guys are the good guys. Grierson, what? Also, Jared Leto, man, he's really doing something awfully daring.
Oh, is he in it?
He is. Oh. And, you know, if you were to go up to him on set and say, hey, Jared Leto, how's it going? Do you think he would have responded?
Well, I mean, he's a normal human being, so I would assume so, yes.
But see, that's the thing.
Oh.
Is he was so deep into the character, so deep into his world of chaos, that Jared Leto was gone.
Can we tease next week's episode that if people listen next week, I'll tell my story of interviewing Jared Leto at his house?
Oh, yes, 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 yes.
Not for Suicide Squad. This was a while ago.
I'm going to absolutely put that in the show notes to make sure I did not forget to ask you about that last week. And I as well will be doing, in honor of Jared Leto, will be doing the whole episode without breaking character as Jared Leto.
I'll be playing the part of Viola Davis giving you side eye from Comic-Con during that.
See, I was just hoping that you would play the part of Tim Grierson interviewing Jared Leto and never break character.
I could do, well, we have a week. I'll work on both parts, see which one feels right.
We'll workshop it.
I got your back.
We only have one review next week, though. I think Tim, who will be reviewing Suicide Squad for the New Republic, but Tim will be writing about Little Men for New Republic next week, so we may have him talk about that for 5 minutes, but and no more than 5 minutes. I'll stop you at 5 minutes. And then we have two reboots next week. The two reboots we have, the first one is Shallow Grave. Shallow Grave, of course, directed by Danny Boyle, came out in 1994. So we'll be discussing that movie with Ewan McGregor and Christopher Eccleston. I can never say that guy's name right.
I think
I missed a couple C's. And then we also are in our second reboot. We will be discussing Ryan Johnson's Brick, which came out in 2005. Ryan Johnson, of course, directing the next Star Wars movie, directed Looper, and went to college with Grierson, which I'm sure will come up on the podcast next week. So that, of course, starts Joseph Gordon-Levitt and Lucas Haas and Emile DeRaven, a few other people. The film noir thriller at a high school in California.
Yeah, we'll have two stylish debut thrillers next week for our reboot segment.
Now, because I know Brick was a Sundance movie. I don't know if Shallow Grave.
I would have to go back and look. I don't. My memory is that it's not. But yes, but Brick definitely premiered at Sundance.
I'm very excited to talk about Brick. I'm excited to talk about Brick with you. So, all right. So that is the show this week. Grierson, I think we did pretty well. I hope. Now the problem is because this is a Jason Bourne podcast, we're not going to remember it.
Yeah. Or we'll just go away for 9 years. One other quick thing, and again, it doesn't really matter. If you go away for 9 years, how do you make a living? Do you just punch people? Was that what his job was? He like punched people in boxing rings and got like money for that? Or how did he even like survive?
I assume that it was actually probably the highlight, but probably the best Jason Bourne's life has been for his, and ever since he got turned into a killer and lost his soul and lost his memory, is that the one thing he really wanted to do, which was just to get in fights so that he cannot feel, because the pain is so overpowering, he made a living out of it. You know, what you have to do in the world, Grierson, is find what you love, make a living at it, and then just do that forever. That's the definition of happiness.
Oh, you lecturing me on that, by the way, gave me a chance to discover that Shallow Grave premiered at Cannes.
I wasn't lecturing you. I was giving you life advice.
I wasn't even listening. That's the tragedy of our relationship right there. Look at that.
You are history's greatest monster. All right, everyone. I can't believe we've 28 episodes in. This is the first time I've called you history's greatest monster. That's my favorite insult. All right, Grierson, have a wonderful week. We'll be back next week to talk about Suicide Squad, Shallow Grave, and Brick. See you, everybody.
Bye. I'm going full-blown commando. Headband like Rambo, Navy SEAL paintball, Banksy drawing blank walls, deals made like Jordan, champagne with Jeff Gordon, straight up A's and Warden, Cuban Stokes, I import them, whirlwind tornado, fired up volcano, red hot eruption, when we get to touch it, I wanna find a way into the eye of the storm, save the world and get the girl, she call me Jason Bourne.